This desk is neat. There is a pile of books on it, and a ruler. There is also, at the moment, a clock made out of cardboard. Miss picked it up. The other teachers in the school were known as Stephanie and Joan and so on, but to her class she was very strictly Miss Susan. Strict, in fact, was a word that seemed to cover everything about Miss Susan, and in the classroom she insisted on the Miss in the same way that a king insists upon Your Majesty, and for pretty much the same reason. Miss Susan wore black, which the headmistress disapproved of but could do nothing about because black was, well, a respectable colour. She was young, but with an indefinable air of age about her. She wore her hair, which was blonde-white with one black streak, in a tight bun. The headmistress disapproved of that too. It suggested an archaic image of teaching, she said, with the assurance of someone who could pronounce a capital letter. But she didn't ever dare disapprove of the way Miss Susan moved, because Miss Susan moved like a tiger. It was, in fact, always very hard to disapprove of Miss Susan in her presence, because if you did, she gave you a look. It was not in any way a threatening look. It was cool and calm. You just didn't want to see it again. The look worked in the classroom, too. Take homework. Another archaic practice the headmistress was ineffectually against. No dog ever ate the homework of one of Miss Susan's students, because there was something about Miss Susan that went home with them. Instead, the dog brought them a pen and watched imploringly while they finished it. Miss Susan seemed to have an unerring instinct for spotting laziness and effort, too. Contrary to the headmistress's instructions, Miss Susan did not let the children do what they liked. She let them do what she liked. It had turned out to be a lot more interesting for everyone. Miss Susan held up the cardboard clock and said, "Who can tell me what this is?" A forest of hands shot up. "Yes, Miranda."
"It's a clock, Miss."
Miss Susan smiled, carefully avoided the hand that was being waved by a boy called Vincent, who was also making frantically keen "ooh, ooh, ooh, ooh" noises, and chose the one behind him. "Nearly right," she said. "Yes, Samuel?"
"It's all cardboard made to look like a clock," said the boy. "Correct. Always see what's really there. And I'm supposed to teach you to tell the time with this."
Miss Susan gave it a sneer and tossed it away.
"Shall we try a different way?" she said, and snapped her fingers. "Yes," the class chorused. And then it went, "Ah!"
as the walls, floor, and ceiling dropped away, and the desks hovered high over the city. A few feet away was the huge cracked face of the tower clock of Unseen University. The children nudged one another excitedly. The fact that their boots were over 300 feet of fresh air didn't seem to bother them. Oddly, too, they did not seem surprised. This was just an interesting thing. They acted like connoisseurs who had seen other interesting things. You did, when you were in Miss Susan's class.
"Now, Melanie," said Miss Susan, as a pigeon landed on her desk, "the big hand is on the 12, and the enormous hand is nearly on the 10, so it's—"
Vincent's hand shot up.
"Ooh, Miss, ooh, ooh!"
"Nearly 12 o'clock,"
Melanie managed.
"Well done, but here—" the air blurred. Now the desks, still in perfect formation, were firmly on the cobbles of a plaza in a different city.
So was the classroom. There were the cupboards, and the nature table, and the blackboard. But the walls had vanished. No one in the plaza paid the visitors any attention, but, oddly, no one tried to walk into them either. The air was warmer, and smelled of sea and swamp.
"Anyone know where this is?" said Miss Susan.
"Oh, me, Miss, oh, oh!"
Vincent could only stretch his body taller if his feet left the ground.
"How about you, Penelope?" said Miss Susan.
"Oh, Miss!"
said a deflated Vincent. Penelope, who was beautiful, docile, and frankly dim, looked around at the thronged square and the whitewashed, awning-hung buildings with an expression close to panic.
"We came here in geography last week," said Miss Susan. "Cities surrounded by swamps,
On the Vieux River. Famous cookery. Lots of seafood. Penelope's exquisite brow creased. The pigeon on Miss Susan's desk fluttered down and joined the other pigeons prospecting for scraps amongst the flagstones, cooing gently to the others in pigeon-pigeon. Aware that a lot could happen while people waited for Penelope to complete a thought process, Miss Susan waved at a clock on a shop across the square and said,
"And who can tell me the time here in Genoa, please?"
"Oh, Miss, Miss, oh!"
A boy called Gordon cautiously admitted that it might be 3 o'clock, to the audible disappointment of the inflatable Vincent.
"That's right," said Miss Susan. "Can anyone tell me why it's 3 o'clock in Genoa, while it's 12 o'clock in Ankh-Morpork?"
There was no avoiding it this time. If Vincent's hand had gone up any faster, it would have fried by air friction.
"Yes, Vincent."
"Oh, Miss, speed of light, Miss, it goes at 600 miles an hour, and at the moment the sun's rising on the rim near Genoa, so 12 o'clock takes 3 hours to get to us, Miss."
Miss Susan sighed. "Very good, Vincent," she said, and stood up. Every eye in the room watched her as she crossed over to the stationery cupboard. It seemed to have travelled with them, and now, if there had been anyone to note such things, they might have seen faint lines in the air that denoted walls and windows and doors. And if they were intelligent observers, they'd have said, "So, this classroom is in some way still in Ankh-Morpork and also in Genoa, is it? Is this a trick? Is this real? Is it imagination? Or is it that, to this particular teacher, there is not much of a difference?" The inside of the cupboard was also present, and it was in that shadowy, paper-smelling recess that she kept the stars. There were gold stars and silver stars. One gold star was worth 3 silver ones. The headmistress disapproved of these as well. She said they encouraged competitiveness. Miss Susan said that was the point, and the headmistress scuttled away before she got a look. Silver stars weren't awarded frequently, and gold stars happened less than once a fortnight, and were vied for accordingly. Right now, Miss Susan selected a silver star. Pretty soon, Vincent the Keen would have a galaxy of his very own. To give him his due, he was quite uninterested in which kind of star he got. Quantity, that was what he liked. Miss Susan had privately marked him down as boy most likely to be killed one day by his wife. She walked back to her desk and laid the star tantalizingly in front of her.
"And an extra special question," she said with a hint of malice. "Does that mean it's then there when it's now here?"
The hand slowed halfway in its rise.
"Oh," Vincent began, and then stopped. "Doesn't make sense, miss."
"Questions don't have to make sense, Vincent," said Miss Susan, "but answers do." There was a kind of sigh from Penelope. To Miss Susan's surprise, the face which one day would surely cause her father to have to hire bodyguards was emerging from its normal happy daydream and wrapping itself around an answer. Her alabaster hand was rising too. The class watched expectantly.
"Yes, Penelope."
"It's..."
"Yes?"
"It's always now everywhere, miss."
"Exactly right. Well done. All right, Vincent, you can have the silver star. And for you, Penelope..."
Miss Susan went back to the cupboard of stars. Getting Penelope to step off her cloud long enough even to answer a question was worth a star, but a deep philosophical statement had to make it a gold one.
"I want you all to open your notebooks and write down what Penelope just told us," she said brightly as she sat down.
And then she saw the inkwell on her desk beginning to rise like Penelope's hand. It was a ceramic pot made to drop neatly into a round hole in the woodwork. It came up smoothly and turned out to be balanced on the cheerful skull of the Death of Rats. It winked one blue glowing eye socket at Miss Susan. With quick little movements, not even looking down, She whisked the inkwell aside with one hand and reached for a thick volume of stories with the other. She brought it down so hard on the hole that blue-black ink splashed onto the cobbles. Then she raised the desk lid and peeped inside. There was, of course, nothing there, at least nothing macabre, unless you counted the piece of chocolate, half gnawed by rat teeth, and a note in heavy Gothic lettering saying, "See me," and signed by a very familiar Alpha and Omega symbol and the word Grandfather. Susan picked up the note and screwed it into a ball, aware that she was trembling with rage. How dare he! And to send the rat, too! She tossed the ball into the waste paper basket. She never missed. Sometimes the basket moved in order to ensure that this was the case. "And now we'll go and see what the time is in Clatch," she told the watching children. On the desk, the book had fallen open at a certain page, and later on it would be story time. And Miss Susan would wonder too late why the book had been left on her desk when she had never even seen it before. And a splash of blue-black ink would stay on the cobbles of the square in Genoa until the evening rainstorm washed it away. Tick. The first words that are read by seekers of enlightenment in the secret, gong-banging, yeti-haunted valleys near the hub of the world are when they look into the life of when the eternally surprised. The first question they ask is, why was he eternally surprised? And they are told, when considered the nature of time and understood that the universe is, instant by instant, recreated anew, therefore, he understood, there is in truth no past, only a memory of the past. Blink your eyes, and the world you see next did not exist when you closed them. Therefore, he said, the only appropriate state of mind is surprise. The only appropriate state of the heart is joy. The sky you see now, you have never seen before. The perfect moment is now. Be glad of it. The first words read by the young Lutze when he sought perplexity in the dark, teeming, rain-soaked city of Ankh-Morpork were, rooms for rent very reasonable, and he was glad of it. Tick. Where there is suitable country for grain, people farm. They know the taste of good soil. They grow grain. Where there is good steel country, furnaces turn the sky to sunset red all night. The hammers never stop. They make steel. There is coal country, and beef country, and grass country. The world is full of countries where one thing shapes the land and the people. And up here, in the high valleys around the hub of the world, where the snow is never far away, this is enlightenment country. Here are people who know that there is no steel, only the idea of steel. But they still use forks, or at least the idea of forks. There may, as the philosopher says, be no spoon, although this begs the question of why there is the idea of soup. They give names to new things, and things that don't exist. They seek the essence of being and the nature of the soul. They make wisdom. Temples command every glacier-headed valley, where there are particles of ice in the wind even at the height of summer. There are the listening monks, seeking to discern within the hubbub of the world the faint echoes of the sounds that set the universe in motion. There are the Brothers of Cool, a reserved and secretive sect, which believes that only through ultimate coolness can the universe be comprehended, and that black works with everything, and that chrome will never truly go out of style. In their vertiginous temple, criss-crossed with tightropes, the balancing monks test the tension of the world, and then set out on long, perilous journeys to restore its equilibrium. Their work may be seen on high mountains and isolated islets. They are small, brass weights, none of them bigger than a fist. They work. Well, obviously they work. The world has not tipped up yet. And in the highest, greenest, airiest valley of all, where apricots are grown and the streams have floating ice in them even on the hottest day, is the monastery of Oi Dong and the fighting monks of the Order of Wen. The other sects call them the History Monks. Not much is known about what they do, although some have remarked on the strange fact that it is always a wonderful spring day in the little valley, and the cherry trees are always in bloom. The rumour is that the monks have some kind of duty to see that tomorrow happens according to some mystic plan devised by some man who kept on being surprised. In fact, for some time now, and it would be impossible and ridiculous to say how long, the truth has been stranger and more dangerous. The job of the history monks is to see that tomorrow happens at all. The master of novices met with Rin Po, chief acolyte to the abbot. At the moment, at least, the position of chief acolyte was a very important post. In his current condition, the abbot needed many things done for him, and his attention span was low. In circumstances like this, there is always someone willing to carry the load. There are Rin Po's everywhere. "It's Lad again," said the master of novices. "Oh, dear, surely one naughty child can't trouble you." "One ordinary naughty child, no. Where is this one from?" "Master Soto sent him. You know, of our Ankh Morpork section. He found him in the city. The boy has a natural talent, I understand," said Rin Po. The master of novices looked shocked. "Talent? He is a wicked thief. He'd been apprenticed to the Guild of Thieves," he said. "Well, children sometimes steal. Beat them a little and they stop stealing. Basic education," said Rin Po. "Ah, there is a problem." "Yes." "He is very, very fast. Around him things go missing. Little things, unimportant things. But even when he is watched closely, he is never seen to take them." "Then perhaps he does not." "He walks through a room and things vanish," said the master of novices. "He's that fast? It's just as well Soto did find him, then. But a thief is—" "They turn up later, in odd places," said the master of novices, apparently grudging the admission. "He does it out of mischief, I'm sure." The breeze blew the scent of cherry blossom across the terrace. "Look, I am used to disobedience," said the master of novices. "That is part of a novice's life. But he is also tardy."
"Tardy?"
"He turns up late for his lessons."
"How can a pupil be tardy here?"
"Mr. Ladd doesn't seem to care. Mr. Ladd seems to think he can do as he pleases. He is also smart."
The acolyte nodded. "Ah, smart." The word had a very specific meaning here in the valley. A smart boy thought he knew more than his tutors and answered back and interrupted. A smart boy was worse than a stupid one.
"He does not accept discipline," said the acolyte.
"Yesterday, when I was taking the class for temporal theory in the stone room, I caught him just staring at the wall, clearly not paying attention. But when I called out to him to answer the problem I'd chalked on the blackboard, knowing full well that he could not, he did so. Instantly. And correctly."
"Well, you did say he was a smart boy."
The master of novices looked embarrassed.
"Except it was not the right problem. I had been instructing the 5th Gym field agents earlier, and had left part of the test on the board. An extremely complex phase space problem, involving residual harmonics in N histories. None of them got it right. To be honest, even I had to look up the answer."
"So I take it you punished him for not answering the right question?"
"Obviously. But that sort of behavior is disruptive. Most of the time I think he's not all there.
He never pays attention. He always knows the answers, and he can never tell you how he knows. We can't keep thrashing him. He is a bad example to the other pupils. There's no educating a smart boy.
The acolyte thoughtfully watched a flight of white doves circle the monastery roofs.
We cannot send him away now, he said at last. Soto said he saw him perform the stance of the coyote. That's how he was found. Can you imagine that? He'd had no training at all. Can you imagine what would happen if someone with that kind of skill ran around loose? Thank goodness Soto was alert. But he has turned him into my problem. The boy disrupts tranquility.
Rinpo sighed. The master of novices was a good and conscientious man, he knew, but it had been a long time since he'd been out in the world. People like Soto spent every day in the world of time. They learned flexibility, because if you were stiff out there, you were dead. People like Soto... Now there was an idea. He looked towards the other end of the terrace, where a couple of servants were sweeping up the fallen cherry blossom.
"I see a harmonious solution," he said. "Oh, yes? An unusually talented boy like Lud needs a master, not the discipline of the schoolroom. Possibly, but..."
The master of novices followed Rinpo's gaze.
"Oh," he said.
And he smiled in a way that was not entirely nice. It contained a certain anticipatory element, a hint that trouble might be in store for someone who, in his opinion, richly deserved it.
"A name occurs," said Rinpo. "To me also," said the master of novices. "A name I've heard too often," Rinpo went on. "I suppose that either he will break the boy, or the boy will break him, or it is always possible that they will break each other," the master mused.
"So, in the patois of the world," said Rinpo, "there is no actual downside."
"Would the abbot approve, though?" said the master,
testing a welcome idea for any weak points.
"He has always had a certain rather tiresome regard for the sweeper." "The abbot is a dear, kind man, but at the moment his teeth are giving him trouble, and he is not walking at all well," said Rinpo. "And these are difficult times. I'm sure he will be pleased to accept our joint recommendation. Why, it's practically a minor matter of day-to-day affairs."
And thus the future was decided. They were not bad men. They had worked hard on behalf of the valley for hundreds of years. But it is possible, after a while, to develop certain dangerous habits of thought. One is that, while all important enterprises need careful organization, it is the organization that needs organizing rather than the enterprise. And another is that tranquility is always a good thing. Tick.